I had planned to give just a typical traditional sermon, but as we were reading, the text that we read from Genesis 1 just kept jumping out at me. So I hope you'll forgive me. I have to say a little bit about it because it's really an extraordinary text. We live in a time where there is great controversy over nature. How long have we been living with nature? Anybody have an idea? Like a few billion years, right? How long has the human race been around? A couple hundred thousand years, right? Well, what if it were only 1,000 years? Or maybe only 500 that we'd been living in nature? Don't you think after at least 500 years we'd somehow figure out what our relationship to nature is? How is it that after all of this expanse of time and all the things that we've done together, that we still are in this incredible controversy about nature? In two ways. One is the study of nature itself, we call it science, and the other is the results of nature, and that's kind of our experience with nature. The overwhelming majority of scientists, not in America, not in Western Europe, not in Canada, but the whole world, virtually all, there's a handful of scientists who say there is no such thing as global warming, or global warming is just, it always goes on, it warms and it cools and it warms and it cools and it has nothing to do with us, Jack. There is this idea that all that science teaches us about the climate is false. Now I ask you, if you had a physical ailment of some sort, and there was a doctor down the street, and the doctor was somebody that was actually a journalist, but he read a lot of medical articles, and down the other end of the street, there was a doctor with an MD, which one would you go to? The journalist who'd read a lot of articles out of the Time magazine, or the doctor who'd been to medical school with and has an MD? Well, that's the choice that we have today. We have people that really don't know anything about science, opining on science, including in the highest offices of our land, telling us that, in fact, nature is not what we think it is, that we are not really part of nature, and we can do anything we want to nature. So that's kind of the backdrop to this wild Genesis 1 passage. I'll just pick out a couple things that are especially interesting. In the past, people that were refuse to believe that the Bible had anything to say important about the world of nature or about anything else, looked at the verse that said, "Then God said, let there be light, and there was light." Okay, we all know that verse. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Well, then how, and that's, what day is that? Anybody remember what day that occurred on? First day. First day God. So how, when you get down to season, day four, it says, "And God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the days from the nights, and let them be for signs and seasons, for years." So here, light is created on the first day, but we wait till the fourth day to find out, well, where do we get our light from? Anybody know? Where do we get our light from? Mushrooms? Where? The sun, yes. I knew we could get it. If we worked just hard enough, we'd come up with it. The sun. And what else, sort of? The moon, and a little bit less, the stars. Sun, moon, and stars. Okay, so you have been around for at least 1,000 years, and you know that much. This is great. We're on a roll. God said, let there be light, but then 3 more days go by, and there's no sun. 3 more days go by, there's no moon, there's no stars. So they obviously were confused. Well, what this was the theologians of Israel sort of sticking it up the nose of their, they were in captivity, the people from Judah are carried off into captivity. They're in captivity as slaves in Babylon, Babylonian Empire. And while they're there, they hear about the great god Marduk, who creates the sun and the stars. And the Jews they didn't have a story about creation. They just didn't. All their story had to do with life on earth, had to do with history, had to do with the struggle for justice, the struggle for freedom, how to escape from slavery. They didn't have anything to say about the creation of the universe, and they realized this is a fault, we have to rectify. So they took elements out of the Babylonian creation story and wove it into their story of a God who creates and loves the world. But they're tweaking the nose of the Babylonians because they say, the Babylonian story, when you read the Babylonian story, there is no light until what? Until the sun is created. There is no light until there's a moon and stars. And so the great god Marduk provides these things, and isn't he great? Well, Jews come along and say, that's nothing. Our God creates light, and he doesn't need the sun, the moon, and the stars. Well, for the Babylonians, the sun, the moon, and the stars are what? They're gods. They're divine beings. The Jews don't recognize divine beings outside of the one God. So in this story, the Jews are saying that God created light. And oh, by the way, 4 days later, he doesn't need it for the first 3 days. 4 days later, now he needs it. And he puts it up, the stars, the sun, and the moon, in the dome of the sky. About the dome of the sky. The dome of the sky, maybe you know about this. You know what a dome is. Okay. This is actually a double dome. There's a dome above, and there's a dome below. And right now, in the last month, we are experiencing what this text prophesies, in a sense. The text represents, talks about the deep, unbounded fear of the seas, of the oceans, that they get out of control. And behind that is clearly, most scientists think now, there was a massive breakdown of natural walls up in the Black Sea area. And it rushed down into the Palestinian, into Mesopotamia, into Egypt, into Israel. And there's a cultural memory of the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives that were lost. And so there's this deep fear of the seas. So in the creation story, the Jews say, well, the seas are such a danger, so God creates a dome and separates the seas from above and the seas from below. The seas from below are the natural floodings, like a seiche. You don't have seiches out here. What do you call it? Hurricane. And the dome above is the sky where the waters fall from. And this is a terrifying thing. So when they create a creation story, they are looking at how God creates a space for human beings. But there's always the danger of chaos breaking through. And there is this sense in this story that that is always a threat. The dome, and we have experienced it. We have experienced when you have 48 inches of water, of rainwater, the dome is not working. When floods come rushing in and cover huge acres and acres and acres, the dome's not working. This is the threat that underlies every time you see the word seas in the Bible. Talking about the sea or the oceans. Every time you see it, it always has a double meaning. It has the meaning of, there's the Atlantic Ocean, and the other meaning is there's a threat. The Atlantic Ocean always represents a threat, as do all seas. And then finally, in this quick survey, down at the bottom says, God said, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and all the wild animals of the earth. And this has caused, among scholars, a huge controversy. About 30, 40 years ago, a man that worked in a project I worked in wrote a very famous essay called The Bible at the Roots of the Ecologic Crisis. And he makes an argument that the reason we have an ecological crisis is because of this verse. Because the Bible said, you take dominion over all creatures of the earth. And that was meant to mean, originally, in its original Hebrew form, it was meant to say that you are responsible for caring for all the creatures of the earth. You have a job as a steward, as a gardener, to care for all the creatures of the earth. However, the way, and Lynn White is right, we took this passage for 2,000 years or longer, We took this passage to mean we can do anything we want. Nature belongs to us. God gave it to us. We can do anything we want. And it doesn't matter how much we destroy it. So given that, why do we do this every year, bless the animals? Is it just to kind of bring in animal lovers? Is it just a kind of sentimental, I used to think it was, it's just kind of sentimental Christians, they like to do silly things. But why do we do it? Why do we bring our animals with us to worship? I very rarely have a three-point sermon. But I'm going to give 3 points why we do this. One, we do this to acknowledge our oneness with nature. The traditional views, traditional theological religious views, as well as traditional cultural views, separate us from nature. We are distinct from, if you go back to the 60s, and certainly before that, almost everything you would read about humankind's relationship to nature is that we are separate one from another. Not only separate one from another, we are superior one from another. So we do this, bring the animals to worship, as a way of acknowledging our oneness with nature. Just like in the lesson that we read on the fifth day, it's wonderful. All of the animals, the land animals, are created together. We're created along with the buffalo. You know, we're created along with our dogs and cats. So we have a kind of kinship with the animals that walk the earth. The day before, it's the birds and the great monsters. Well, if you read a little bit in Scientific American or Popular Science, you know probably what the dinosaurs evolved into, right? Birds. So in this passage, the birds and the dinosaurs are put together, future and past. But what we are is we are part of this great web of nature. We are part of it, and it is part of us. The problem is that when we think that humanity is seen as superior to nature, we create havoc. Two, why do we do this every year? We look at the world, all creation, and ourselves through the eyes of God. That is, through the eyes of love. When we look at our animals, we look at them with love, certainly. But for the most part, over our long history of relating to animals, mostly animals have been work creatures. And they're treated pretty badly. God, throughout Scripture, God looks upon animals with love and favor. And it's only these animals that look upon animals with the rest of the animals with as purely instrumental creatures that have no value in themselves. We do this so that we can look at the eyes of our animals through the eyes and love of God. And the third, we recognize that nature has value that is intrinsic, not just instrumental. What do I mean by that? Usually when the human race is thought of nature and animals, it's thought of nature and animals in the sense that, what is the value of a sheep? What is the value of a tree? What is the value of a mosquito? Well, in the past, no one asked that question. Because it was assumed that all of those creatures had value insofar as we could use them. If we had no use for a plant or a creature, we can kill it. But it has no use. It has no intrinsic use. The use is, or the value is instrumental. That is, we can turn it into an instrument that we can use. And of course, once we develop the mindset that nature is simply has value only instrumentally, then we start treating it as it has no value except as it meets our needs and desires and interests. Finally, we bless the animals as we bless ourselves, and we bless each other. And when we bring them to be with us, surrounding us at worship, it's our way of giving thanks to God, not just for these animals, but for all of nature, and by caring for all of nature, always. Amen.